Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms, the talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, polemical, but always interesting. And our guest this week is Andrew Copson, and I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce Andrew.
Thanks, Padraig. Andrew Copson works for the British Humanist Association on education and public affairs. Andrew coordinates the BHA's campaigns for a secular state, for an end to religious privilege and discrimination based on religion or belief, and for a rational humanist perspective on public ethical issues. He also coordinates the BHA's educational work, promoting understanding of humanism as a non-religious worldview, both in formal school and college curricula and to the public at large. Andrew, thanks very much for coming on to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
Well, let's first of all talk about the history of the British Humanist Association. When did it start?
Well, it started about 1896, and it started as a coming together of various groups around the country that had come together because they were not religious, but they shared an ethical concern about humanity and about the world. These groups started in local areas, and then eventually in 1896 they got themselves an umbrella body called the Ethical Union. And the Ethical Union in the 1960s renamed itself the British Humanist Association.
Okay, so what's its aim? I mean, what does it do?
Well, it's a broad raft of activities that the British Humanist Association, the BHA, engages in today. One of the things we're probably best known for in the public at large is training celebrants to do things like non-religious funerals. Obviously, there's a great and growing demand for non-religious alternatives to traditional rites of passage, funerals, weddings, the birth or adoption of a child and so on. So we do that. We also do a lot of educational work to the public, trying to get the philosophy of humanism better known, getting more people in public life to express their own humanist beliefs and values, and also making sure that that worldview is given fair coverage in schools when they're teaching about beliefs and values. And we do a lot of lobbying, as you say, campaigning for a neutral secular state and for a humanist perspective on public bioethical issues.
Well, perhaps before we actually look at some of the campaigns a bit more closely then, perhaps we should, for the benefit of our listeners, talk a little bit more about what the philosophy of humanism actually is then.
Yeah,
so what
sure.
is a humanist?
Well, a humanist, the word humanist has had a lot of different meanings throughout the past, and they're not all connected. The same word has been used in many different contexts. The word humanist is used today and has been for about the last 100 years to roughly describe someone who has a naturalistic view of reality in the world, someone who doesn't believe that there's a second level to reality, some supernatural level where there might exist gods or ghosts or goblins or angels, someone who believes that in that context, this life that we have is the only life we have, that there's no existence, personal existence after death. They're sort of convictions. And then there are also values. Broadly, we would say that a humanist, in terms of values, was someone who believed in putting human welfare and fulfillment at the centre of ethical or moral discussions, rather than adherence to some creed or dogma or doctrine. And someone who believes that in the context of ultimate purposelessness to the universe, human beings individually and collectively create their own narrative and meaning and purpose for each other.
The main thing the BHA would be known for in the past year or so would be the atheist bus campaign, which has done a huge amount to put humanism, even though it's described as atheist, in the spotlight. But
yeah.
But I mean, combined with that and going back earlier to maybe criticisms of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens' books, as do you think there's a legitimate criticism that humanism has become quite, preachy?
Preachy to the public, trying to convert, trying to
yes.
evangelise for humanism. Well, I think that if it has, then it's only restoring an element of balance to the public debate. I mean, I don't know about other parts of the country so much, but in London we know that there were plenty of Christian posters on the sides of buses and plenty of Christian posters at railway stations and plenty of Christian posters outside churches announcing all sorts of messages to people at large. I think that it's possible that there is a need, therefore, for a sort of corrective perspective to make sure that the views of the majority of people who don't believe in those things are made heard. I think the funny thing about the Atheist Bus campaign was that it was funded entirely by public donations. About 10,000 individuals gave small amounts to get these posters on the sides of buses, far more, in fact, than we thought. You know, we went for £5,500 and we got over £150,000 from the public. And I think that the sort of comments they were leaving on the message board as they gave their donation were things like, oh, good, a chance to have my views heard in this public space. Good that someone is giving this opportunity. Good that this view is going to get out there. And I think that especially with the rising aggression of certain religious groups and religious organisations in Europe generally today, people do think that there's a need for some sort of corrective. Now, I'm sure it would be better if the public sphere generally were not full of those antagonistic and countervailing messages one against the other. But in the context where we do have freedom of speech and freedom of religion, I think that there needs to be a balance for both sides. And the Atheist Bus campaign certainly aroused a lot of public interest.
But do you think atheism and humanism are necessarily in a stronger position now than they would have been in, say, from my experience of the humanist movement, you know, back the 20s and 30s, and seemed to be incredibly vibrant and, you know, movement that felt it was on the verge of a real breakthrough, and then it seemed to subside. Do you think it's actually stronger now than it might have been then? There's some mythologizing going on.
It's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, there is a sort of narrative that some people have, which is that, you know, the 60s was the golden age of the humanist movement, mm-hmm. and sort of in the first half of the 20th century it was on the rise and on the up, and everything was going the humanists' way. You know, big social reforms, homosexual law reform, divorce law reform, suicide law reform. They were all going the humanist way, and then things diminished and wound down, and you know, the humanist movement's a bit lacking in the gusto, until recently at least, that it had in the past. But sometimes in this context, success looks a bit like failure, because in the 1920s and 30s and even into the 40s and 50s, religious morality and the default religious assumptions that went with it pervaded society. Mm-hmm. So you can understand a humanist movement being strong and attracting, you know, pretty wide support in a context where an enormous number of people were negatively affected by religion and by religious norms. The humanist movement seems less vibrant today than it did, and I don't actually personally think it does, but if it did, then I think it would be partially because of the great successes of humanists of the past. I mean, so much medieval rubble in the constitution or in our social laws was swept away in the 20th century, and quite rightly. And to some extent, although the humanist movement in those following decades, the 70s and 80s, might have been less active, in part that was because it looked like they'd achieved what they wanted to achieve. Now, recently, with the rise of the religious lobby, as I say, with an increase of publicly funded faith schools, with a more aggressive and proselytising and conservative Church of England, and so on and so forth, I think we see an increase in the humanist movement again, because it's needed. And there's nothing wrong with going dormant while you're not as needed as you could be.
This is an interesting point, because it seems that, you know, that suddenly there is a need for more vocal humanism because of the, you know, the aggression of various forms of sort of evangelical religion that's going on at the minute. But what, going back to the Atheist Bus campaign, it seems quite interesting that a lot of the criticism that's come from the religious groups, or, you know, if you're reading, I don't know, whatever, your comment is free or whatever, about people criticising that campaign, has been this idea that suddenly the humanist groups are being aggressive and almost like they're not playing fair. Like, it's almost like the religious groups are saying, "Oh, why are they being nasty to us? Why don't they just leave us alone?" Which seems quite ironic.
Well, it's certainly counterintuitive and against all the evidence, isn't it? I mean, it's certainly not humanists who put out the majority of advertising that, you know, questions or criticises other people's beliefs. And the Atheist Bus campaign itself was, of course, noticeably undogmatic and undidactic. I mean, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. It certainly contrasts favourably, I think, with the Christian posters that followed it, that said things like, "There definitely is a God," you know, pretty dogmatic, or "The fool hath said in his heart there is no God," which is pretty rude. You know, that's insulting in a way, though rather silly, so one doesn't feel too insulted by it. The Atheist Bus adverts weren't at all. And I think that it was quite amusing, actually, to see some of the religious critics of the Atheist Bus campaign struggle to condemn it, because, like, these atheists, these fundamentalists, they're so arrogant and didactic, going around saying there's probably no God, and they sort of fell down at the fact that we were saying probably, and, you know, that was quite amusing. There is a double standard, though. There's a double standard, and I think it's partly because Christianity has been a part of public life for so long that it feels more natural, and people don't necessarily notice how strange and all-pervasive it often is.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Stephen Green of Christian Voice famously criticised the Atheist Bus campaign, saying people don't like being preached at. but moving on, we mentioned, we kind of look, as you said, Christianity particularly has been a part of public life so long in not just Britain, but in Europe. And a key part of that would be in education. Mm. In this country, you know, this, for example, is the requirement for Christian assembly in state schools. Mm. And that's a very important part of the BHA's work, isn't it? Mm.
It is. And has been for a long time. I mean, almost from when worship in schools, Christian worship in schools, became a legal requirement, which was, 1944, there have been people who've disagreed with that. And it's not just humanists, of course. It can be Jewish or Muslim or Sikh or Hindu groups and so on. And in fact, the children that are most often withdrawn by their parents from Christian worship in school are the children of Jehovah's Witnesses or of Jewish parents, mm-hmm. and so on. It's not actually non-religious parents as such. We take a view on these issues that is based on the rights of the child to have freedom of thought and conscience and religion mm-hmm. themselves, and also an angle that has to do with social cohesion, that it can't be right to push in schools one particular set of unshared values above others, or to force or compel religious worship of any sort. So, you know, our campaigns against compulsory Christian worship in schools are not based on anti-religious animus per se. They're based on, you know, a wish for more equality and for more educationally useful school assemblies. I mean, teachers know that Christian worship is not appropriate for their assemblies, and most teachers are breaking the law in secondary schools and having mm-hmm. either no assemblies at all or sort of human shared values based assemblies. And, you know, although it is the case that the church has had a long involvement in education in this country, as you say, it's not that long. You know, as I say, the requirement for worship only introduced in 1944. State schools themselves, state funded schools themselves, only came in, you know, a few decades before mm-hmm. that. And the church actually tried to prevent the introduction of universal state education for quite a long time because it threatened their own monopoly of it. We'd have had a state education system a lot earlier if it hadn't been for the churches.
Hmm. So, I mean, just going back to what you mentioned, it's not just atheists' problem with compulsory Christian worship, which maybe leads on to discussing the Accord movement, which the BHA has been key in, which is a secular in the true sense movement.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That's right. I mean, this coalition called Accord, I'll give it a quick plug, accordcoalition.org.uk, is a really interesting development of the last year, and we've been really pleased to see it. There's a totally false dichotomy that's set up by the media, who naturally look for controversy or balance, as we like to call it, you know, between two competing sides. There's been a really false division set up in the last 8 years or so since faith schools started to increase in number, between, on the one side, a religious group which is portrayed as totally homogenous and all being in favour of faith in education, and a sort of strident, secularist, anti-religious, humanist lobby on the other, which is against faith schools and wants to crush faith entirely. And of course that's not true, and never has been true. Well, the Accord Coalition demonstrates very clearly how that is a lie, and that the true situation is that there are many people, and the majority of people in this country, of whatever religion, or of humanist beliefs, who are against state-funded faith schools. It's chaired by a rabbi, Rabbi Jonathan Romaine. It includes amongst its supporters Anglican priests, non-conformist ministers, Jewish groups, Muslim groups, and teaching unions. It's a very broad-based coalition that's trying to reset the terms of the debate and make clear that, in fact, many people of many religions, as well as humanists and teachers and so on, are opposed to discrimination in state-funded schools. So I'm glad you brought it up. It is an interesting development, and it's been very successful so far.
Perhaps we could just widen that out then to just a discussion of the concept of secularism itself, yeah. Because people might have a perception that secularism itself per se means, you know, is somehow atheistic in itself, and that's clearly not the case,
no.
Is it?
No, indeed. I mean, again, sort of rather like the word humanism, where can be confounded by definitions, because when the word secularism was first used in Britain in the 19th century, it meant a sort of atheistic, non-religious approach to life. Of course, it doesn't mean that anymore. It now very clearly means the separation of religious institutions from the institutions of the state, or at the very least a neutrality of the state in matters of religion or belief. And in that aspect, in that definition, it's a precious asset to religious people and to non-religious people.
Indeed.
I mean, if we look today at countries in the world where religion and the state co-mingle, countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia or many of the countries that are the worst today in the world for human rights and freedoms and liberties, we find what the opposite of secularism is, and it's very negative. And in Europe we can go back relatively recently and see the nexus of church and state as having deplorable effects on people's lives, on their liberty of conscience and their freedom of speech. So secularism, in the case of the state being impartial and neutral between people of different religions and beliefs, is important for everyone.
Yeah, well, let's talk about one of the just recently the launch of the Association of Humanist Students, is one of the things that you've been involved in as part of the the education aspect of the BHA. So tell us what that was.
Well, that was a development that was really interesting. I think that it comes back to the question earlier, actually, about humanist movement in the past and the humanist movement today, because there was a very successful federation of university humanist groups from the 1950s to the 1970s, and then it sort of wound up in that general job done, no need to worry type atmosphere of the time. And now what we have is very much a student-led movement, about 16 or 17 or almost 20 campus-based atheist, humanist or secular student societies have sprung up in the last couple of years, and they formed a national umbrella organisation last month, which we supported. It seems sometimes counterintuitive, because universities should be places of free expression and the free exchange of ideas and education in its truest sense, but there's a lot of problems on campus these days for free expression. The Warwick University Atheist Society have had posters of theirs banned for allegedly inciting what was called racial hatred, but of course it wasn't. It was actually criticism of a religion, and those two were elided together to have their posters banned. Other campus groups have had their own posters defaced and their events disrupted and so on in a really unexpected way. Christian unions are increasingly active evangelically and proselytizing on campus. Islamic societies are the same. And there have obviously been recent cases of academics, so not students, but the staff, the faculty of universities, facing censorship of some aspects of their work on religious grounds. So the need for student groups is greater now than it ever was before. And I think it's always necessary, because quite apart from lobbying for changes in law or secularism in the state, you've got to win the battle of ideas as well. And the universities are places for that. They've traditionally been places of great humanist and endeavour, and it's good to see a campus-based movement now starting up of its own accord, as it were. I mean, we didn't generate or seek to found this organisation. When the students came to us and asked for our support, we gave it, but it was totally student-led, which I think shows how obvious the need was for people on the ground.
So where do you expect that to go then in the future?
Well, I think they're going to try and be a national voice for the different student societies. Mm-hmm. They won't ever be a coordinating body with branches in each university like the Christian or Islamic Student Society national bodies are, because they do want to give their affiliated societies more freedom than that. I think they'll carry on doing what they're doing at the moment, which is organising debates and discussions between religious and non-religious people, holding sort of weeks. Reason Week is a very popular concept, which is spreading from student group to student group. Started, I think, in Southampton and then in Leeds, and is proving tremendously popular with students. Spreading those sort of humanist ideas, making them accessible to more people. Campaigning to some extent for reforms often of university chaplaincy systems, which of course is one aspect of a privilege for religions, in that there is often university funding for chaplaincies for additional religious support and not for additional non-religious support on many campuses. And I guess they'll be trying to grow the number of societies that they have. I mean, 20 is very good for 2 years, but it's by no means a majority of universities in the UK. More and more groups are starting up, and I guess that the AHS, which is the name of the organisation we're talking about, that the AHS will be looking to stimulate more groups too. They had an amazingly successful launch. Richard Dawkins and Polly Toynbee and AC Grayling all agreed just like that to come and speak, because they were so excited by the concept, and it was a tremendously energetic and dynamic launch. You really felt it was going to go places quite quickly.
Is there a problem, and problem which may be countered by getting younger people involved, but is Is there a problem in the criticism that atheism and humanism are very white, very liberal, very middle class ideals?
Mm. This is a charge that's always levelled, isn't it? I mean, you know, the idea that, as you say, humanists are white, middle-aged, liberal men, or grumpy old men sometimes. And it's not actually true. You find that non-religious humanist beliefs and values are shared by people in Britain of all ethnicities and ages and so on, and that the fastest growing humanist organisations in the world are those in Africa, in Nigeria and Uganda in particular, have been extremely successful in the last few years, and that probably one of the largest humanist movements in the world is in India, which is, you know, very significant. So globally, it's not obviously just a white middle-class endeavour. To some extent, you know, the charge that humanist organisations are mainly sort of middle class and white in this country is a fair one, but that's only because any membership organisation is. You know, you could say the same thing about the National Trust or the, you know, RSPB or whatever. You know, people who have the money and the time to join organisations often are sort of affluent and or middle class men. Actually, the gender distribution in the BHA membership is roughly 50-50, so that's quite good. But joiners, people who have money and time to join and the inclination to join membership organisations, are usually of a certain demographic. Of course, that doesn't mean that humanists are. You know, not every humanist in this country is a member of the BHA, obviously, because there are probably around, you know, 17 or 20 million people who share beliefs and humanist beliefs and values in this country, and, you know, there are 10,000 members of the BHA.
So. Then we come to the problem of definition of whether people want to define themselves or whether people are even allowed to define themselves as atheist or humanist, which is, you know, the census, for example, is tricky. You'd end up with a lot of others.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, there is a problem with definitions, with words, because unlike a religious identity, obviously the word humanist is not an identity, it's a description. It applies sort of post facto to some beliefs and values that firstly historically already existed and the word was coined to cover them, but in people's own lives they may hold without ever having heard, from the moment they're born to the moment they die, the word humanist, although hopefully the BHA will help to change that. So as you say, words, some people are sort of denied the knowledge of the word that might apply to them, and you find it all the time when people are do find the BHA or join the BHA. Oh, this is what I've always believed all my life, I never knew there was a word for it, or, you know, an organisation representing people who believe what I believed. The census is a good manifestation of that problem, because it shows how misconstrued the terms of definition that are used can be. I mean, the census of 2001, which was the first time a question about religion was asked, famously gave a ridiculously large percentage of people saying they were Christian, 72%, which has never been replicated in any survey at all, and runs totally counter to the British Social Attitudes Survey, which has, you know, found a far smaller proportion of Christians. But you understand why the result they got was 72% when you realise that the question they asked was, what is your religion? They didn't ask, you know, are you religious, yes or no, and if so, what? In which case they'd have got a far higher proportion of non-religious people. They asked a closed question, what is your religion? And they asked it straight after a question about ethnicity, leading many people into the tick white, tick C of E trap. I mean, and everyone knows in the world of sort of academic demography and, you know, plain sort of common sense, will say that if you ask a question like, what is your religion, more people will say they're religious than actually are. Changing the census question is one of our campaigns, actually, one of our less sort of sexy and on the side of a bus type campaigns, but one we've been working on for the last 10 years. We thought we had some sort of success because the Office of National Statistics, which run the census, admitted that the question was flawed and said that they would look into changing it. But then we didn't hear back from them for about a year, and it turned out they were going to use the same question again. So difficult to make a change there.
Can we just look at one of the other things when I read out the introduction, talking about the campaigns, and I just want to perhaps get a sort of definition of what this is. We talked about an end to religious privilege, and perhaps we could talk about what does that mean?
Yeah, well, religious privilege, most of our work, of course, is about discrimination based on religion or belief. So, for example, in admission to state schools, or in the provision of, you know, chaplaincy resources in hospitals or whatever. But there is, of course, in a country like ours that has an established church, a certain amount of religious privilege as well. And when we're talking about that, we're talking about the superior status that is given to some ideas and some people who have certain ideas within the institutions of the state or within the public sphere. So to some extent that's informal, you know, the assumption of a default Christianity in public life, whether it's just by, you know, prayers before council meetings or prayers in Parliament or the sort of general assumption that people will share sort of Christian values or define themselves in a Christian way. But it also has, you know, real political consequences too. We're the only country in the, you know, developed West that has places for particular religious denomination reserved in our national legislature.
Mm-hmm. You know, so bishops,
there are bishops
in
the House of Lords, and the only reason that they're there is because they've been appointed to a particular Anglican bishopric to sit there. They're all men, of course, because there aren't any women bishops yet, at least, in their position. And they have a totally disproportionate representation in Parliament compared to how many people share their beliefs in the public at large. You know, they're not even representative of their followers. In the vote on the assisted dying bill, which would have allowed assisted dying for the terminally ill, which about 81% of Anglicans or Protestants say they're in favour of, all the bishops were against it and turned out en masse, you know, to vote it down. So there's a disproportionate influence of one certain brand of one certain religion in our national parliament, which is very much an institutional problem, an example of religious privilege. There are many others. I mean, we can't pretend that we live in a theocracy and that there's so much religious privilege that, you know, we're ground down by it every day. We're not living in a country like that at all. But we are living in a country where we don't have a genuinely open society and a genuine rule of law and a genuine democracy because there is privilege given in certain areas to certain people simply because they have certain religious beliefs. Which, of course, one can't change. One can't change one's religious beliefs through an act of will alone. One believes what one believes. And so it's purely circumstantial, in a sense, that certain people are privileged and certain people are not.
Well, we'll have to look at means of tackling that next time you're on, Andrew, because we're out of time. But thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.